Welcome to another...
The official podcast of The Leaky Cauldron.
The Leaky Cauldron.
The Leaky Cauldron.
Do you hear that, Earth? The Leaky Cauldron.
Just go! You're wasting time!
Welcome to Pottercast, the official podcast of The Leaky Cauldron, your number one source for theories, news and discussion, and interviews from the books and the films like me, the Rupert Grint. I play Ron Weasley in the Harry Potter films. And now your hosts, Melissa, John and Sue.
Okay, it is the middle of October, it's almost pumpkin time, but first it is time for Pottercast number 121.
Aww, I want pumpkins. Pottercast.
I do want pumpkins too. Welcome, I'm Melissa, I'm here with John and Sue. As usual, we're here for another week of Harry Potter stuff. Before we do anything, we have to hear from our lovely friends at The Borders.
Today's Pottercast is brought to you by Borders. Haven't read Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows yet? Don't worry, Borders is here to help. Pick up your copy of this summer's smash hit soon. You won't be able to hide from those spoilers forever. You can count on Borders to have it in stock and ready to take home tonight, along with the audiobook version. Even if you've read the book, the Harry Potter fun doesn't have to end yet. Visit BordersMedia.com or click on the Borders banner at the top of the podcast page to find out more.
Hey, guys.
Ooh. Hey.
It's October.
What's that mean?
Now.
If you haven't read Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows by now.
Yeah. And you managed to download a podcast about Harry Potter. You are as backwards as very backwards person.
Anyway, Pottercast this week features, it's such a packed show, we got to keep this real short up here, guys. We have a Canon Conundrums is back.
We were
never taking it away. We just had some recording issues. We have a Phoenix Files. We have a Bit by Bit. We have a Scribby Five. It's just a wild, giant show, so we got to go right into the news, Sue. What's going on?
Oh, filming has now begun in Scotland for the Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince film.
Meaning there's Hagrid's Hut?
Well, we don't know, but no, they started on the Hogwarts Express, though.
Okay.
Cool, I read that article, too. I actually read news this time.
Good, this is always good. But you know what's interesting? That not only did they film scenes at the Hogwarts Express, but they've been filming at,
A lock, right?
Lock.
It's pretty.
Lock keg. I'm sorry, people of Scotland, I apologize, but I don't know how to say it.
They don't have the internet out there yet.
But it said an airborne film unit and cameraman aboard a fish farm boat have been shooting computer-enhanced sequences above and on the lock.
I'm curious to how they're calling them computer-enhanced sequences when, unless some technology is eluding me, they're out on the day shooting with a camera, and they don't bring all of their computers with them.
Yeah, it sounds like they're shooting things that will eventually be computer-enhanced.
It's such a funny thing to add into a thing. Everything in the darn movie is computer-enhanced. There's not a single frame that's not computer-enhanced. Whatever.
But it was just, I don't know if it's for the scenes for the cave or what, but it's just nice to know that it's actually, those highlands of Scotland are just absolutely gorgeous, and they're in the same area, and they're keeping the continuity, and it's just beautiful, and I can't wait to see it.
Do you know what I can't wait for 6 to come out? Because then we're going to get fan films to Michael Jackson's Thriller.
Oh, God.
The Inferi. I can't wait. I want to see that fan film. Just keep it in the back of your head for next year, guys.
What did he call it? The Army of the Dead or something, or...
Army of the Dead.
Oh my God.
Army of the Dead, baby. You know,
are they
going
to be green and they're going to run through all the orcs and it's going to be like, why didn't you get here an hour earlier? We all would not have died.
Well, if Dumbledore shows up with a sword of Gryffindor, then we know that Peter Jackson's been in the area.
Dumbledore and his giant wooden flashlight that's so powerful.
That he borrowed from Moody. Bam!
Yeah, more or less.
That he bangs on the floor and all the Inferi die.
Here comes the Lord of the Rings fan's email.
All right, guys, we have to keep going through this. I'm sorry.
Congratulations are in order to Miss J.K. Rowling for her... She's the new recipient of a special recognition award from the Pride of Britain Awards, and Miss Emma Watson presented them to the award to Joe and for all of Joe's charity works.
That video was too dang cute.
It is.
It was. Joe was.
I almost had a tear in my manly eyes.
You know, wasn't it sweet, though? I mean, here's this girl that, you know, that won the Pride of Britain Award... recipients had gone up there, and then, you know, here comes Joe, and Emma was, and Joe was just beside her. I think she was genuinely moved by the stories of these people. It was just
I don't know, guys, did you see her hair?
Who's
Joe?
No, I'm kidding. Everybody's all
Who's
like,
hair?
Emma's hair is so blonde, oh my God, Hermione doesn't need to have that blonde hair.
Yeah, I know.
Emma doesn't
need to
come until December, guys.
Emma.
Oh, just Joe.
You know, either way, I have to say, though, without being hopefully tabloidy about it. Emma's clothing choices are so wonderful right now.
Yeah.
She, not only this beautiful dress that she wore, but at the last award show we saw her, she was in like this very kind of chic thing with these nice heels. Like she's turning into a real fashion plate, which is nice. It's nice to see them grow up and look nice and, you know.
Surely she can afford it.
You know, and...
Yeah. Well, the irony there is that she probably gets it for free.
That too. Yeah, she's a Chanel model now, isn't she?
I think so.
Yes. And I'm sure she has advisors from there, but this outfit that she wore to the Pride of Britain Awards wasn't a Chanel outfit, but it was a beautiful gown. Yes. They were both in black. Joe, look, I thought equally chic and very beautiful.
Dan Radcliffe was going to be a clothing model, but he turned him down.
All right, so there's some news about Joe and the family additions, huh? I'm just trying to get us straight through this, guys.
I know. She has a new member of the family, everyone.
That puppy dog.
You know who else has a greyhound?
Yeah, so it's not just a regular puppy dog. It's one from the Greyhound Rescue.
Somebody in our Leaky family has a Greyhound. Our friend Lisa Q. Lisa QQQ from Akio.
I remember that great. That was a Greyhound.
Arrow. That was a Greyhound.
Arrow, yeah.
Yeah.
They're cool dogs.
He's in our podcast video blog on podcast.
Was Arrow in there? She make an appearance?
Yeah.
Arrow is in there.
Yes.
Sweet.
Blog number 7.
I watch our blogs.
Let's get right through it. We've only got a couple minutes left.
Okay, this is a cool thing that Warner Brothers is doing. Although, you know, when the Order of the Phoenix DVD comes out, this is important, that when you buy the DVD, it's going to come down with two versions of the film that are available for download. So you can put them on your computer and put one, like, on for your portable media player or your iPod or whatever.
That is crazy. That's such a big deal. People are buzzing about that in the tech community, even who aren't Harry Potter fans. That's a big move for a movie as big as Harry Potter. So.
I think they're the first studio.
Yeah, they are.
And I just, you know, and considering that there's the month discrepancy between or time between the UK gets it a month before we do.
I still guarantee
that's going to change because Argentina is getting it in October. Like, it's going to change. You know?
Talk about 100 typos.
But what?
There must have been 100 typos that caused this debacle.
It's not even that. It's not even about the U.S. just to get it first. It's not about that. You're talking about the biggest market for these movies in the world. All that's going to happen by leaving that separate is that it's going to hit the digital networks much sooner and cut right into sales because people are going to be downloading it.
Yeah.
You know, they should get it to the U.S. before anywhere else, I think.
Just want to make one last bit of news, which is funny, and I want to hear John McTiernan's reaction to the Ron Weasley.
Oh, God. How perfect.
What did he say?
Why can't we have these for every movie?
He says stupefy.
He's like, I think we would have stopped some kind of wizard army. And then he's like, the bit about when, like, I let her win. Yeah, it's only polite and whatever it was. And big families and afraid of spiders. And
like sweets.
I like a lot of sweets and sort of a... No, I want me some room.
He didn't say, your hand's all sweaty.
I can't, your hand's all sweaty.
I can't.
Anyway.
But I mean, and now we got a new Hermione Granger one. She only says 4. Ron says 6 things, but the Hermione figure only says... But I mean, it's just so... The quotes that they chose for her are even worse.
What's that?
And I was just like, you know... Oh, it's like... Is he really out there? We've got to be able to defend ourselves. And if Umbridge refuses to teach us how, we need someone who will.
That's all one quote?
That's one quote.
Matt, you, Harry. Thanks, John. All right.
We have
one more bit of news this week, which is a bit of our own. And look, we're actually going to sort of make time.
Okay.
Our own news is that we have just started early this year. For the first time ever, we're like on a good time schedule. Our annual Get a Clue charity drive is now open.
Yeah.
We actually closed last year's, which was the Get a Clue around Book 7, which raised close to $4,000 for Book It International, which we're very excited about.
Yes.
This year, we asked the Wizard Rock bands to donate a song each. 14 bands created a whole new song for us each. They donated it to Leaky. Frack illustrated the work. We had a professional sound mixer mix the CD, and it is being produced as Jingle Spells, a Wizard Rock compilation holiday CD. It's now available for pre-order. You can only get it through December 10th. You can only order it through December 10th because we're making a limited amount, and we can't be shipping these out forever. I'm literally going to have 30 boxes of CDs in my apartment for a while.
And if we don't sell them, we're going to burn the rest.
No,
a big bonfire.
No.
But that's really, it's $15, which includes shipping if you're in the U.S. It's a little extra for international. And I'm telling you, it is some of the best Christmas music, not just Wizard Rock music, some of the best Christmas music that I've ever had on my iPod.
And this is no smoke being blown here, fellas and ladies. This is from somebody who is not as obsessed as some of the fans out there of the Wizard Rock. I swear, this is the most Wizard Rock I've ever listened to, ever. I mean, I love Christmas. I love Christmas songs. So if there's anybody out there who loves Christmas songs and has even a passing interest in Harry Potter, this is a CD for them this Christmas, because it won me over after like two songs. So.
Right. And you can be able to hear previews of this, right, Melissa?
Yes.
We'll have previews
up on, there'll be a link at the top of podcast.com where you can go to our order page, which has our previews. There's a 30-second preview of every song. We'll be playing previews in podcast from now until eternity. And it's just so much. There's funny songs. There's warm Christmassy songs. There's slow songs. There's fast songs. There's the Whomping Willow song will kill you with laughter.
Yes.
I'm just completely stunned by what these amazing people donated for this album.
Yeah.
And if all goes well, we're going to raise huge amounts of money thanks to it. So,
awesome.
Really exciting.
That'll make for a very happy book aid.
And a lot of good Christmas gifts. Anybody you know who likes Harry Potter, dude, it's the best gift. And it's cheap. 15 including shipping. That's really cheap for an album.
Well, they don't have to take our words for it. We're going to be playing clips here at the end of this episode. And like you said, you can listen to 30-second clips already now on the Wiz Rockopedia and soon to be on Leaky and other places, and it will be awesome.
Yay!
All right, well, let's go do the rest of the show, please, now.
All right, let's kick it over to the Bit by Bit.
Hey, guys, Kimmy Blair here. This week, we are going to listen as Ashley, known as Chocolate Is Not For Breakfast, Owen, known as Nimbus XL, Sarah, known as Stabscal, Libby, and Julie, known as Amina, are going to discuss the next bit of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. Now let's listen to their fan thoughts as they talk about the departure of the Dursleys as they head off to live with wizards, possibly never seeing Harry again.
The whole Dudley liking Harry in the end, I thought that was really contrived. I thought that it was like, okay, where did this even come from? It was done well. I just don't know if the idea was something that I would necessarily agree was in his character. I think that, you know, it was funny, but I don't know, the whole leaving tea out for Harry was a little much.
Chapter 3 was a welcome bit of humor and hope. Here, the references of past events, such as the Weasleys collecting Harry for the World Cup trip and Hagrid's chase to bring Harry to Hogwarts, was much better handled. They were part of a conversation that was actually going somewhere. The admittance of Dudley that he appreciated what Harry did for him 2 years ago was a nice touch and installed a bit of hope for me that this book wasn't going to be all doom and gloom.
Harry's last meeting with the Dursleys did not go the way I expected at all. I was convinced that Petunia would have some mind-blowing confession to make to Harry, or that in the very least she would have an important piece of information to pass on to him. I was shocked that the closest he came to an emotional connection with any Dursley was with Dudley.
The humor in this chapter it's great, because when Dudley is saying goodbye to Harry, he's being so un-Dursley-ish, and I think that is actually a really important turning point, especially for Harry, because he sees that after what had happened to Dudley, he got a new sense of begrudging respect for Harry.
My favorite part of Chapter 3 was after the Dursleys had left, and Harry's going around looking at everything that were bad memories to him, and just almost being sarcastic when he's talking to Hedwig about them, like the cupboard under the stairs, or being able to sneak upstairs whenever the Dursleys finally left.
And we are back with Bit by Bit. It's Melissa, Sue, and John, and we're here with our special fan guest. Here we have Andrew. Hello.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to be going through Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, and this week we're talking about the Dursleys departing.
All those Dursleys. That's crazy.
I know.
Well, first, what we do is figure out who you are in three questions.
Yes.
We ask you who your favorite character is, what your favorite moment from any of the books are, and I think it was what your favorite book in general is.
Okay. Well, favorite character, without reservation, Neville. Absolutely. I think I knew as far back as before when we start to find out about his past that, you know, next to Harry, he'd probably have the best overall character arc. So you can probably guess what my favorite scene is.
The sword?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, not just that he killed the snake, but with all the parallels that should have been parallels to Harry and the Chosen One, that Neville's the one who gets to have the King Arthur moments and pull the sword from the hat. That was just immensely satisfying to me.
And your favorite book, I'm guessing, then, would be what?
It's a toss-up. I mean, if I go on just sections, I think the first and final quarters of Deathly Hallows are, you know, absolutely my favorite in the series.
Uh-huh.
I think once I make my peace with that long middle section and the fact that the trio, I mean, count it, they're in those tents for 9 months.
Yeah.
I think once I make my peace with that, Deathly Hallows will be my favorite. Until then, I'll probably have to go with Order of the Phoenix. That has probably my favorite character moments
nice.
In the series. So...
We'll argue with you on the 9 months.
A lot of people are coming around to those 9 months.
Well, let's see. They leave the ministry. The ministry attack is like the very, it's the beginning of September. And then isn't the incident at the Malfoy mansion over Easter?
Yeah,
and
no.
Then it takes a couple, because it says like Draco's home for Easter holidays.
So it's like up on, like through March. So you have September, March. 7 months.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a long time to live in this country.
It's still a long time. I think Stephen King brought it up in that great post-mortem he did for Entertainment Weekly. I think he mentioned how it sort of felt like Joe was running the clock out to make it fit the format for the rest of the series. So, overall, that's probably the biggest and most insignificant quibble I have with the final book.
That's cool. This bit by bit is about the Dursleys.
Yeah. Saying farewell to old Dudley. It actually turned out to be quite a surprise. I thought this chapter actually really surprised me, I have to say.
It did catch me off guard, too.
A little bit. I mean, what did you think was originally going to happen to the Dursleys? What role did you think they'd play?
I always had the one theory about Petunia, that she was going to haul Harry up to the attic and, like, show him something from his mom that she'd been holding on to. And she'd been waiting and waiting and putting off to give him, like, something interesting or meaningful that they would depart upon Harry before he left. And I was very surprised just to see, you know, that short chat and waving him out the door, and that was it, the whole rest of the book.
I mean, I sort of knew that there was going to be an attack on Privet Drive when Harry turned 17, but I thought the Dursleys would be right in the thick of the action. And instead we got a scene that was... you know, almost entirely character-driven. If anything, it kind of reinforces what I said earlier, that Dudley may be okay, but there's really no hope. There's no hope at all for Vernon and Petunia.
Yeah.
You know, Vernon spends the scene thinking Harry's trying to get them out so he can get the house. That's all he can think of. And
yeah, I know. He's like, are you lost your mind? And Vernon's rambling on about the prices of housing and stuff. It's like, you know, we're in the middle of a war and he's worried about house prices.
But it must be so weird for them, for Harry to come and say, we're in the middle of a war, your life is in danger, all this stuff is happening. And to them, all they know is that it's like sort of damp and chilly out, you know?
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
So it's a hard thing to swallow as a muggle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like for anybody to be told that, all of us over here are in wartime, and you're just chilling there with your biggest worry is, the worry for your safety is getting hit by a car in front of your house. There's nothing scary to you. You don't know what's going on.
And especially for Uncle Vernon, here's a man who has spent the entire series in denial and hatred and loathing of Harry and his lot, as they keep saying. And yet, here we are, the irony of it is that lot that he so despises is actually going to save his sorry... you know, Tush. And
oh,
I just
God,
find that just, you know, very amusing. I don't know.
Who was it that came? Do you remember their names? It was Delia Stiggle and somebody.
Hestia Jones.
Hestia Jones. Mm-hmm. And where have we seen her before?
She was on the advance guard when she came with the Order of the Phoenix. They described her as a pink-cheeked witch or something. I thought, I don't know.
She wasn't named in the advance guard, but...
Oh, okay.
Enough.
Yeah, I just remember hearing her name before as being part of the Phoenix. I thought she had done something before, but maybe not. For some reason, I just was kind of hopeful she was a Hufflepuff, but I don't know. Always hoping, you know.
Everybody who's never been named or given a house is a Hufflepuff by default until proven otherwise.
The thing I love in this chapter is that Vernon is babbling on and babbling on and babbling on, And then all of a sudden, Dudley, of all people, speaks up and says, I'm going with the wizard. See you later. You know, Dudley, of all people, starts to make sense.
Yeah.
Dudley, who walks around with his hands on his butt because he doesn't want another pigtail every time he sees the wizard, suddenly he's like, yeah, whatever, I'll go with him.
Yeah.
And it's cool because, as Harry discovered, as he thought about it, he hadn't really interacted with his cousin at all since that big ordeal at the beginning of Phoenix.
He never said anything in Half-Blood Prince. He just sat there on the couch.
That's a long time to ponder something as intense as that ordeal was to them. I think it's quite believable that he would figure it out.
See, I was sort of left wondering, going into the final book, whether there would ever be any kind of, not reconciliation, but whether the Dursleys would ever, you know, understand what they had put Harry through. And I think the closest we come to it is that great moment where Harry tells them all the possibilities of what would happen if they were captured, and how Voldemort would torture them, and basically hope that Harry would come to rescue them. And there's that moment where Joe says that Harry and Vernon looked at each other and they were both wondering the same thing.
Yeah.
And she never says what that is, but Vernon maybe even would bother after the way he treated him.
Yeah, totally. Whether or not he would actually say, of course he would. He's Harry.
Yeah.
He'd save a stranger.
No, I agree that he would, but that moment for Vernon was...
Poor Vernon. What do you guys think?
I love Harry when he's up against the Dursleys because he gets that black humor, that Harry, that dark, sarcastic humor that's so different from Ron. And it makes him such a different person. Like, I love when Dudley's asking, well, why isn't Harry coming? And Vernon just sort of sputters, well, he doesn't want you, don't you? And Harry goes, not in the slightest. You know, it's like, he probably would rather go hang out with the Dursleys than be running around at the Voldemort's Horcrux here. But the way he says, you know, not in the slightest, just awesome.
Yeah.
Classic Harry. It's like the big D conversation from book 5 was like the best Harry ever.
It was.
So having read through this book more than once now, for everybody but me apparently, do you feel good about how they left things with the Dursleys or how Joe left things?
No.
I think they were fully resolved as characters and the role they had in Harry's life.
Yeah, I kept waiting to see them again, and it never... eventually I realized that it never happened, and the last time it dawned on me, the last image we would see of them is them driving down Kirby Drive in the car and disappearing, which it took me a while to make the connection, but that's also the exact same ending for the Wormwood family and Matilda, whom the Dursleys are so often compared to. The Roald book. Matilda.
Yeah.
That, you're right when it started, when the Harry Potter book started to become a really big thing, they started talking about all of Rowling's influences. And I kept hearing everywhere that the Dursleys were very much in the line of the Wormwood family, the cruel, abusive relatives.
Yeah.
And the final, these are the final lines of the book. It's, neither of them said a word as they stood there watching the big black car tearing around the corner at the end of the road and disappearing forever into the distance as they move on the greener pastures. So I don't know if that was intentional or not.
Pretty similar.
On Joe's part, but...
Food for thought.
Well, I had such a problem with... And I know we're kind of skipping Dudley and his peace offering of the teacup, but... I was really disappointed in Petunia in the sense of how the chapter ended. And this is what upset, and I'm leaping ahead because at the end of the book we understand that she had been rejected. That she had been rejected, she wanted to go to Hogwarts and stuff, and yet here she had spent the entire series, the whole of Harry's life rejecting this child. In many ways she had. And I know this will be a source of controversy when you say this, but I thought that she would have had some sort of I have been hoping for some sort of compassion or just a little bit moment more than her pausing and hesitating as she was about to go out the door. And I just felt that there was more to Petunia that should have been said. I understand why Joe didn't want to, but I cannot tell you. It's just maybe as a human being, I was just so disappointed.
Well, you want to expect better for people.
Yeah.
Everybody had high hopes for this woman that she would, come around at least to say something to this kid. I mean, he was pretty much her mom figure his whole life, as crappy a job as she did. This was her last chance to impart anything on him, any feeling, any, you know, regret or apology or anything. And she just couldn't bring herself to do it. She was not that strong of a character.
I understand it's her character not to give, that she has been a person that she has given only to Dudley and not to Harry. But I just, I don't know.
It just says something sort of great about humanity in life. You don't always get any ending.
Yeah, that's true.
Such an extended neat ending with Dumbledore. He gets neat endings with Dumbledore all over the place. Not always like that.
Yeah.
People aren't that strong. They don't say something. Also, narratively, probably would have given away too much.
Yeah, I would have. Yeah, absolutely I would have. I agree.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I know we had just remember beforehand, and I'm sure, Andrew, you probably know, all the speculation about what Petunia, what was the last, and I wanted to know, and oh my goodness, and all the theories we had about, something was going to be revealed at the Dursley house, and then, I don't know.
I never thought the thing that would be revealed about Petunia was going to be anything too major. I thought we'd find out that she actually did care about Harry, some small part of her, but then...
Yeah.
She does.
I thought it was her big secret was going to be that she had the Elder Wand all along.
Yeah.
She was waiting to give it to Harry.
Mm-hmm. The thought did cross my mind.
Can we talk about the teacup? Real quick. One second.
Well, the goodbye between Harry and Dudley.
Okay. Yeah, let's talk about that. Just real quick. What do you think?
The goodbye?
I don't know.
I like it. I like the handshake.
I mean, I thought it was nice. I think we said that's what I think the purpose of the scene was, that to show that, unfortunately, while Vernon and Petunia could never change, they could never accept Harry, he at least made his impact in no small way on Dudley. And if he's ever able to amount to anything for the rest of his life, it'll be because of Harry.
There's hope in the children.
There's always hope, John. Hope is never lost.
Well, that is all the time we have for the Bit by Bit, because the last few Bit by Bits ran long because we didn't have a kind of conundrums or conclusions. Now we do, as we're bringing back, trying to regulate these things.
We lost Melly.
We shall say goodbye, sans Melissa, and find her.
We'll have her back in a few minutes.
We will continue after we hear from some good words from the Scribby Gals.
Welcome to Scribby 5, the 5-minute podcast of the Leaky Cauldron's premier essay project, Scribula. I am Erin, or Calpia.
Hey everyone, and I'm Nina, or Severine Snape.
Hi, I'm Linda, known as Mosaic.
Today, we are, believe it or not, talking about Snape.
Yay! Well, of course you're thrilled about that, Nina. I mean, I hate to be critical of all your Scribby 5 work since I'm kind of new around here, but being a huge Pottercast fan, I must say I've observed a disproportionately large number of Scribby 5 issues have been about the greasy git.
Aww.
Erin, maybe you should consider a new topic.
Well, Linda, I know what you're saying. And, of course, with Nina here, people are prone to assume that we're going to talk about him just because of her unhealthy obsession with the guy.
Oh, come on, Erin. The therapy sessions have been doing wonders for me, I have to say.
Well, that's good. But actually, I was taking the time to look through all our essays today, and I couldn't believe how many we have and how amazing they are. We will be working harder than a one-armed house elf to get them all converted over to our new system over the next couple weeks, so you listeners can read them again, too. I mean, we actually have 158 published essays.
162, if you count the ones that are coming up in issue 19.
Yep.
I know, and all complete with thorough research, citations, bibliographies. I found that very impressive when reading your site before I became staff. I mean, most online essays don't even bother with references.
Yeah.
True. But my point for bringing this up is that I did some quick statistics, and it turns out that 19 of these essays are about Snape, and this doesn't include the ones in which he features as a minor player or the ones that were designed to be indirectly persuasive regarding an issue that was related to him. Anyway, that's 1/8 of our essays. And we received many more on him that were not accepted. So basically, Nina, you can relax a bit. You are not the only person out there completely obsessed with him.
Well, that's good to know.
So what you're saying, Erin, is that you're obsessed too?
That isn't what I meant. Yeah, I guess so. But seriously, to write a really exciting essay on something, you sort of have to be a bit preoccupied with the topic. I mean, scribulous essays do take time and commitment. There is the research, the writing, the proofing, the editing, the bibliography. It's fulfilling, but still, it isn't something to embark on lightly. A great essay usually means obsession with the topic.
Oh, yes, how true, how true.
Oh, give me a break.
So, basically, today, I looked through our essays and came up with three essays that brought up an issue that I would really like to understand, but which Jo Rowling did not answer in Deathly Hallows.
And are they all, coincidentally, about Snape?
Why, yes.
And I repeat, yay!
So, first off is Madame Pince. Is She Really Eileen Prince by Pam 2002, and it's in issue 14.
Yeah, we did a previous Scribby 5 on this essay, but just to give a quick recap, Pam wrote a very compelling essay that linked Irma Pince to Severus Snape with the assertion that she was his mother.
Yes. So Deathly Hallows comes out and no Madame Pince. In fact, she wasn't even mentioned in the Battle of Hogwarts at all. Was she hiding in her library restricted section, perhaps?
That's possible. So, wait, are we left to wonder if the I'm a Prince anagram is simply a coincidence?
And the chapter placement that sets Madame Pince mirroring Snape's behavior in consecutive chapters of Order of the Phoenix?
Yeah, that too.
Yeah, we are.
Indeed. Yeah. Jo, if you are listening, I really want to know, is Irma Pince related to Eileen Prince?
Yeah,
please.
Yeah, Jo, we really want to know. Tell us.
Okay, next essay is Keep Your Mouth Shut and Your Mind Closed by...
me.
Great essay, Nina. That was in issue 6, by the way. I really think you have some interesting observations and criticisms of the occlumency subplot in Order of the Phoenix.
Oh, Erin, I haven't blushed so much since John Noe told me he liked my new earmuffs.
You know, I've read that essay. I remember you point out, and I would agree with you, that you would like to believe that Snape was way too smart to leave his most secret memories in a pensieve alone in a room with a notoriously overly curious student.
Yeah, I mean, it's just plain dumb. I mean, he should have known not to put them in the pensieve right in front of Harry and then leave the room not once but twice. I mean,
exactly.
Unless he wanted Harry to see them.
Right, Nina, and that's the point. So, Jo, if you are listening, we really want to know, was Snape intentionally plotting to reveal things about his past to Harry?
I mean, it is possible that Snape wanted Harry to see his dad at his worst, but even then it doesn't quite make sense.
Yeah, I agree.
I know. Okay, so that brings us to our final essay. It is Severus Snape Beyond the Grassy Knoll by CBM, and it's in issue 18.
Oh, Erin, I know you love that essay, but it was as wrong as your Draconian Prince one was.
I know.
Well, I heard someone say you guys suggested he name it Severus Snape Beyond the Greasy Knoll.
Yes. That was a clever joke made by Hedwiger 7. But you know, Clark, the author, worked on it so hard. I mean, he had a really good case there. He found a huge time gap of nearly 8 hours between when Harry told Snape about Sirius being at the Ministry in Order of the Phoenix and when the Order actually arrived to help.
Yeah, but I think it's very unlikely that Jo would have put in as much time as the author did studying the timeline. I mean, I just don't see her on the Naval Observatory website checking the time of sunset or analyzing the speed of a flying Thestral. I mean, she herself has said that she's not that good in math.
I know, Nina, that is true. But she lives in Scotland, and she wouldn't have to look up the exact time of sunset to know that in summer it's around 10 p.m., and she takes the train to London, so she'd know it's a far trip. I mean, I think she wouldn't need to go to such detailed measures to figure out that it was a really long time gap for Dumbledore to refer to as at once.
So, okay, what are you suggesting, Erin? Is it just a plot flaw or what?
Well, sadly, I do have another theory, and I know Clark is inclined to agree with it. I mean, let us say that Dumbledore did know with fair certainty that Harry could not be killed by Lord Voldemort. The biggest thing that needed to happen in Order of the Phoenix was for the wizard world to find out Lord Voldemort had returned.
Oh.
So it is possible that Dumbledore actually wanted it to go down, that for Harry to end up at the Ministry in order to reveal Lord Voldemort to the world.
Oh, I see.
Ooh, well, I think that theory is a bit out there, Erin, but it's a good one.
Yeah, well, I do have a tendency to get into the really crazy theories, don't I?
Yes, you do.
So, Joe, if you are listening, we want to know why there was such a long time gap between Harry going to Snape for help and Snape reporting this to the Order.
All right, so if you're listening, Joe, please, please answer our question. Well, that's it for everyone this week, and we'll see you all next week.
Yes.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye, everybody.
Well, good afternoon. Tut, tut. That won't do. Now, will it? I should like you, please, to reply, good afternoon, Professor Umbridge. One more time, please. Good afternoon, class.
And we're back with Phoenix Files. I'm guest host Andrew here with the Pottercast Trio, and this week we will be talking about Umbridge's first Defense Against the Dark Arts class and the subsequent detention with Harry.
Woohoo! Not too bad.
Oh, John.
Thank you.
You woohooed!
All right, so Umbridge, anyway. We have her class.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be on the show this week to talk about this scene, because, I mean, this may be an odd choice, but I think this is probably my favorite sequence in the entire series thus far.
Well, why would that be?
Well, I mean, where do we begin to talk about Imelda Staunton in this film?
She kicks butt.
She's just so fantastic. What she brought to the character, I mean, I never thought, after reading the book, I never thought in a million years I'd feel, well, not sympathy for Umbridge, but she brought so many different shadings to the character that you wouldn't have thought possible. I mean, she really emphasized the fear of the character and, like, her insecurity and the sadism, as we saw in the detention scene. And she just, I mean, it was she nailed it. She totally nailed it.
No, it's interesting. She said something similar. She said that she was expecting it to be easy, you know, villain, whatever kind of thing. And that when she started doing it, she realized what a character she really was.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do you think she was one of the gang who actually read the book?
Yeah,
I do.
I think so.
Has she been quoted as saying as much? Because it seemed to be coming through pretty well.
Yeah, she's read the book, and that's the difference.
Well, she gets a nuance in the levels, and it's also credit to her great acting skills. She's a very accomplished actress, and she can play a variety of parts. But what got me was concerned about her voice. And her little, oh, that laugh, just, it's like nails on a blackboard or whatever, you know, you just, it's so perfect and yet so heinous and just frightful at the same time. And she, I just thought she was absolutely perfect. Just,
I love when Harry starts acting up in class in the book, it mentions that her smile falters, that she seems to, like, her composure seems to crack.
Yeah.
And in this scene, it's just amazing, you know?
Mm-hmm. At that moment, I think it's the moment right after she breaks and she screams enough, and it cuts to that close-up, and you can just see, like, the fear in her eyes when she, like, looks at the class as to whether they're believing Harry.
Oh, Umbridge.
Just the loss of order is what she can't stand.
She is one of the trickiest characters to me, to this day, to figure out exactly how much she was cooperating with who. Whether or not, I mean, we don't ever see her ranked with the Death Eaters, but she gets the hold of so much. I mean, she is wearing the dang locket.
She gets the eye. Mad-Eye's eye.
Yeah.
She just does whatever is going to be best for her at that moment. It's her life is better by going along with things, and it's in line with her beliefs. So, you know, she is definitely anti-half-breed, anti-muggles, anti-muggle-born. That's her up and down.
Yeah, but, you know,
so it goes with her belief system, but she's not going to walk up and murder somebody, you know?
She's sent Dementors after Harry with the knowledge fully expecting them to kill him.
Exactly. She sends other people to do it. She won't do it.
It was interesting. It was interesting they cut that bit of information from the movie. I was a bit surprised they didn't say that she was the one who had sent the transporters in the film.
I'm like, oh, I guess Voldemort did it, huh? Sure.
Yeah.
It was implied in the, at the Wizard Gamut that someone had sent them, but it just was never revealed bluntly that it was her.
I like her looking to her left and right when they say that during the trial. It was pretty funny. She's like, oh.
I mean, we know better, but a lot of the people who were complaining that... I mean, people who don't know the books who were complaining that the movie kind of lacked cohesiveness, that would have...
That's not actually my favorite part of the book, either. I thought it was not...
You think it was too tidy? It was a little too tidy?
So not even... I don't know. I'm not really convinced of her reasoning. Why render him soulless? You know, I don't know. It's not my favorite bit of Joe reasoning ever. You know?
I keep thinking about what you're saying about her being... I don't know if she's just not power-hungry as opposed to just being a Death Eater. I found her to be a very ambitious woman. And her racism and her greed for power and her need for control made her... I think she just kind of lost perspective. Because I don't know. I mean, I just think because ultimately that maybe she did want what was best, like what she was doing, but in her mind, her warped mind. But I don't know. I just...
She truly believed that she was doing the right work.
I mean, she wants power of her own, but she's also completely devoted to Fudge and to serving the ministry.
Well, she's certainly keen on name-dropping Fudge and the ministry all the time, which is a trait that people who just love power and their own power do all the time.
But then, so her in class, and she's got that little, her wand, and there's no need, you know, and...
That cutesy cartoon picture on the book cover. I love that.
Awesome. Yeah, that's brilliant. The book cover was one of my favorite things from the
entire movie. I didn't notice that the first time. I saw the second time, I'm like, oh my god, that's hilarious.
They're reading books into infinity, because it's like a book showing them reading a book, and the book
it's goes back. So clever.
It was a very nice touch. But then we get into the scene where she goes, it's a lie. You know, I wanted to see that so bad. I was just anticipating that moment when Harry was going to stand up, you know, show a little, you know.
Yeah, for real.
I love when Harry first said that, he goes, oh, I don't know, Lord Voldemort, and you hear the pencil drop. You hear the quill drop on the floor.
Yeah.
Dead silence. Amazing.
Oh, so when she says... it is not a lie, and then Harry comes to life, and he springs, and he shows that self, and it's just, that's the moment I have been waiting for, to see the Harry, that the fire in him, and we knowing full well what's coming next, and I was so looking forward to that, and I was like, ah, here it is, you know, and that was the moment I kind of like, I remember leaning forward, and I was like, oh, here we go.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know why, for some reason, when you said spring to life, I pictured Harry as like a somebody's Patronus, like, flying out of a wand and jumping around like a bunny.
Yeah.
I really wasn't sure. We had seen photos before, you know, still shots of what the detention scene was going to be, but I just had no idea what it was going to be like and, you know, how they would film it because, I mean, here she is. She's torturing a child. And it's the grossest abuse of her powers, and it's just so... So I did not know how intense the scene was going to be. And it was just,
you know, I said earlier that this is my favorite scene in the movies to date, and just because I think... Not just because it works on its own level, but this is also, I think, the best work that Radcliffe has done in the movies to date. Mm-hmm. And I'm calling particular attention to that shot right after the words become etched in his skin, and he looks up at her, that mute expression of just... Yeah. Confusion and just the slow, I mean, he doesn't overplay it at all. It's just that slow realization that this woman is a sadist and she's, you know, she's torturing him. And also her look when he's writing, how she can barely contain her pleasure while he's writing. It's just.
And his look, it's not, he's realizing that she's a sadist, but you also see the whole comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
Of how deeply this goes into the ministry, of what this is really about. You see it all dawn there in his eyes, and it's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's great.
He's like, oh no, you didn't just do that to me.
You did.
No.
But he's like, yes, and it's like adult Harry, hero Harry, wise Harry is starting.
Mm-hmm. And Radcliffe, I mean, you know, special props to Radcliffe too. I mean, he went toe-to-toe with Staunton, and I mean, he just completely nailed that scene.
can I say too, this is kind of off topic, but kudos to the set designer, because that set, the Pepto-Bismol pink cat set, was brilliant.
That was so funny. It takes me back to when we were at Leavesden, and the press tent, we mentioned so many times, but they had all those stupid cat plates up there. It was so crazy, hilarious. And there was many, many Mushka jokes in there. But one other thing we saw in there was a still of the actual cutting into Harry's hand there.
Mm-hmm.
And the still we saw said something like, I will not break rules.
I figured it
and
out.
It was the kids.
It was the kids. It wasn't Harry.
We were all like, oh, no, why are they changing that? That doesn't make any sense. It should be I don't tell lies. But then the kids have to do the same detention later, and they will not break rules. That was funny. It was not, you think we would have noticed that it was a girl's hand or something and not Harry's hand. But
yeah,
kind of a little kid's hand.
Yeah. Oh, Harry, Dan, you know, he's, oh, I don't know. Anyway, anything else we haven't touched on this short little snippet of Phoenix Files?
I think that is it this time. Mm-hmm. What's up next on Phoenix Files?
What is up next on Phoenix Files is an excellent question. After this scene, Harry goes back to his good old friends, Ron and Hermione, and they question him about the stuff on his hand.
Oh, they don't.
No, they don't.
No, they go back to the common group, and there's a little flirting with Ron and Hermione, and
yeah,
then
they have a moment.
Harry freaks out and leaves, and then he goes and hangs out with Luna for a bit, and then he comes
back
to Ron's
group. It all runs together when you're not watching it every day.
Effort Trelawney, that's EA.
Well, with that, we thank Mr. Andrew for his contributions this week.
Oh, thank you very much. I've been looking forward to this all week long. This is a thrill.
Very cool. And if you... Oh, well, what?
Nothing.
But if any of you think that it sounded like fun to do what Andrew was doing and Frack and Julian weeks prior, you can do it too, as long as you email staff@pottercast.com. with what you would have said about this week's topics and a attachment of your voice so we know that your mic doesn't suck. And that's pretty much all it takes, and we'll put you on the waiting list.
Okay.
Cool.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Andrew.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, guys.
Now it's time for Canon Conundrums, featuring Steve Vanderark from the Harry Potter Lexicon. Listen in as our panel tries to figure out one specific issue from the Harry Potter canon.
Who could possibly figure that out?
It's time for Canon Conundrums.
Yes.
So have we completely given up on the idea of canon conclusions?
Well, we're just still so confused.
I know. We're not even pretending anymore.
I will continue to live in conundrum land while I'm sure some folks out there are in conclusion land, having read the book more times than me.
Of course, just about everybody's read it more than you, Jen, so...
Hey! At least I finished the thing.
And everybody expected you to continue to live in conundrum land. Topic! What's our topic?
We don't sort of have one, but we kind of do.
Where were the other countries? Where was everybody else?
Yeah.
In book 7.
They were like, fire the missiles.
Where was Madame Maxime? Never missed anything.
Exactly right.
I know. It's like they have this little romance, and it's cute and everything, and, you know, they go find the giants. And then it's like, whatever. She's off with somebody else, probably.
It just baffled me, because all throughout the series, you know, we had the International Magic Cooperation, says Hermione, you know?
Yeah, it was a big deal.
And we had that huge gathering of wizards. We saw this huge body of wizards from all around the world. We had the Wizarding Cup. We have all these things. And then we had the Wizarding Gamut. And yet, we heard nothing. The silence was deafening from them. Where were they? I don't understand.
Yeah, that's really weird, because they just, I mean, like you said, they go out of their way here to Goblet of Fire, to stress how important it is for, you know, the different countries and the different schools to cooperate with each other.
Right. Dumbledore really leads that thought.
Definitely. I mean, at Cedric's funeral... Is it just Hogwarts students, or were all the students there?
Everybody was there.
Yeah, so that was huge.
That's his funeral, when he gave his famous Remember Cedric Diggory speech.
Yeah, and that was the big, you know, everybody needs to come together because there's an evil coming.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like Durmstrang and Bobatones, they hear all this,
You know, and they're all just like, yeah, screw you guys, Britain.
But, you know, maybe part of it is the fact that Dumbledore was kind of the one trying to make that happen, and he's not there anymore in the last book.
Yeah, but does nobody communicate to each other from those schools? Did nobody make pen pals?
The other question is, how effective can any of that communication be when the ministry, the way through which it's official, is taken over? I mean, what can you do when there's been a change of power, and from the outside, it just looks like a new president has been appointed? Do you know, a new minister, a new anything,
uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah.
For our being American, it would be like there was a new president. We might not know that there was some dictator trying to pull the strings, but to anybody else, you can't deny their official ways of operation, or it's like an act of war.
Yeah.
Voldemort is not visible. Although sometimes I wonder, when you have all these methods in this wizarding world for being, you know, Polyjuice Potion and Imperious Curses, why aren't people more suspicious?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? It's like they just buy it. They're just like, yeah. Well, whatever. People are acting really dumb, but, you know, that's okay. It's probably just they're having an off day or something. You know, my immediate reaction is, I'll bet you somebody's taking Polyjuice Potion. You know?
My suspicion is always with the people under Imperius looking oddly slack. Doesn't anybody notice that, like, oddly slack in the face? You know, you're probably under
either the Imperius or hung up.
I'm thinking Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
Half the people are walking around the ministry. Nobody knows.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah, oh, it's fine. Oh, he just had a rough night. Like, what? Come on, guys. Wake up.
But it is true. I mean, when you think about the change in the ministry, because it should be fairly obvious to anybody who's paying any attention. But then you have that other half of the fact that people who do, even if you do catch on, you don't dare do anything because you're going to, you know, you don't know who to trust. You know, it becomes easier just to kind of go along with it. Look at Arthur Weasley, who's working in the ministry, and instead of being one of the people who shies away from the lifts when Harry as Runcorn is making a lot of noise, Arthur Weasley is willing to take people to task. I mean, he's risking a lot when he turns around and takes on Runcorn. Arthur Weasley's a pretty brave guy when you think about it.
Arthur's the man. Arthur's like the Neville of his age.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you have to think about what that would be. This is the Runcorn that's scaring everybody to death. You know, all these people that shy away, run away, are afraid of him. Arthur Weasley just, you know, nails them in the elevator. I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, but it's also really quiet. It's also in an elevator. You're not talking about a stadium full of people.
Yeah, very private little moment.
He'll always say what he thinks is right, and he will always do it, but it doesn't mean that he's taking on the ministry. He's just one-on-one with the guy.
Mm-hmm. A big, scary guy.
But you wonder what, you know, if it wasn't Harry, I wonder what Runcorn or anyone else of these thugs, I mean, the fact that Arthur is still there and still functioning means that in his quiet, unassuming kind of way, he must hold a lot of respect, a lot of authority.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, he's sort of a minor person in the ministry, but everybody knows him.
Yeah. I think he's a pretty tough guy.
But in a totally Voldemortized ministry, if he was that much of a threat, he would have been dispensed with immediately. Look what they did to Neville. As soon as they had nothing else to hold over him, they were gonna either kill him or send him to Azkaban.
Which tells you that Arthur's very good at doing this behind the scenes kind of thing.
Well, but then here's the question. Look how hard it must be to get the correct message out to the wider world of the wizarding culture if somebody working in the ministry like Arthur can't manage to do it.
Yes, but we saw, though, the example of what we call the resistance. We had the wizard, you know.
Potter Watch.
Yes, Potter Watch. And we've had the Quibbler until they shut down Zeno. There are ways, and we saw actually the presence of Fleur and Crumb at some point, and yet we did not get any representation from these other magical, I mean, where was Madame Maxime? Where'd she go?
Well, but then again, how can somebody from Beauxbatons, for example, how can they get the word? They're not going to know how to listen to Potter Watch. All they're going to see is a Daily Prophet, if that. You don't see all that much communication between these places.
Well, aren't there owls? Did Voldemort have complete control over all the information? Did he control all the owls?
I just mean that they don't like reading each other's newspapers all the time or anything like that.
Well, true.
Well, no. It's not just about getting the message out. You can go and shout it from the rooftops. It's about convincing other powers to do something. I hate to bring it into such a real-world context, but look at Darfur. Mm-hmm. Look at what we know is happening in Darfur, and look how impossible it is to get countries and governments around the world to step in and say this is wrong.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Darfur is a little bit more of a clear-cut example. The whole question we have right now talking about Iran, too, and, you know, again, not to bring in too much real-world stuff, but to debate about, okay, what's really going on, and I don't know that I feel like I know exactly what's going on, and I read a lot and listen to a lot. So you think about in a culture like the wizarding world where they don't even have as good of communication, they're going to say, boy, you know, it seems like things are going a little wacko there in Britain, but, you know, that's Britain, and we're not there, and we don't tend to see each other except for every couple of years at a Triwizard or maybe going to the World Cup. You know, the culture's pretty separated.
You know, if it was a movie, then the American wizarding forces would have stormed in at the end.
I'm sure they would have, yeah. Complacing him with Rambo leading the way. Wizard Rambo leading the way. That would be Dallas for him to join up with them in there.
Yeah. You know, so maybe it's Britain in the wizarding world is the largest power, and you think, well, you'd have to take on Britain, basically.
Which just struck me as funny at the end of the big battle, and how serious a threat Voldemort was, and how powerful people like Dumbledore were. This big battle came down to just, in all reality, a very small group of people that was going to solve this for the whole country.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense in a way with the amount of products and so that they turn out, but it really is a small culture. It's not a lot of people.
But I mean, like the people I wondered about was the Wizengamot. Who are all of these people? I mean, they can't all be politicians. Some of them have to be decent wizards.
Okay, but there's this awesome quote, and I think it's Margaret Mead who said that you can't ever doubt that a small group of dedicated people can change the world because they're the only ones who ever have. So it always comes down to a small group of people. A war comes down to a general coming up with the maneuver that turns things around. So I buy it.
Oh, I do too. You know, but then here's another thought. What do you think Voldemort's next move would have been? If he would have finished off Harry and secured power in Britain, what would be next?
Well, she said once that European domination first was his plan. So I think he would have started expanding. But once he set up like a power base, you know, starts to rebuild the whatever pure blood world in Britain, then he would start moving east and west.
I mean, what was his goal? What was he fighting for? Just to have nothing but pure bloods running around? What does he need the whole world for? Why can't he just have, like, settle for, like, a small community or, like, a country club or something?
He's a megalomaniac.
The minute you're going to take over another country, you don't have your same purebloods anymore, right? Kind of missing your point there.
It's all screwed up. Dumb Voldemort.
Yeah.
I think he would have taken over Britain, and that would have probably been enough for him.
I don't know. I mean, I just thought that we saw the evidence. I think Joe did it, obviously, deliberately to just make the point that you're talking about, Matt, that passivity exists out there even in the magical world, and that it is hard to stand up and do what you think is the right thing, even though it's against something that's probably fear. Fear is obviously a great, you know, persuader on both sides, and you know, so maybe that's why she, but I just found it really shocking after through the series we've seen this larger, she had been trying, I thought, was making a move to expand the world and the scope of Harry's knowledge and, you know, bringing in these things, and then it just didn't materialize in the way I thought it might.
You know, thinking about it all, it is kind of nice how she wrote something that was grand, but not so large as that it was so outlandish, unbelievable.
Mm. Right.
And we're talking about a magical world here, but, I mean, I've seen, like, you know, fanfic writers, for instance, that before Book 7, they turned Harry's story into this huge good and evil thing where, like, you know, God himself grants Harry all these extra powers and stuff, and Voldemort kills the devil and takes over all of hell and everything. It's like,
oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, but you got people who are thinking it so huge like that. And then when you distill it down to just a good guy and an evil guy like that, and it's all or nothing, the whole world against each other, that's kind of crazy. That's too much. So I like the scale that Joe kept it on, because...
Sure. And it makes sense, too, because what it came down to was really the final conflict was just the embodiment of Voldemort trying to get Harry.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, I mean, there was perfectly logical reasons why it all coalesced into that spot. He was chasing his Horcruxes and looking at each one of his destroyed Horcruxes, and the last one to go to was Hogwarts. So it made sense that he was there. He didn't go there because I'm going to have a huge final battle and I think I'll attack somebody in the Great Hall at Hogwarts. You know, I mean, it made perfect sense that that's where it ended up.
He still didn't think that Harry was going to be this big threat to him. He was coming after Harry with all, you know, you've been lucky every time, you just depend on other people, you're just a pain in my ass. Mm-hmm. You know, he's going to knock him out right there like that. He wasn't expecting the big battle for
Well,
for
good
everything.
Grief. You'd think by the third time he shot an Avada Kedavra at the kid, he would have realized that maybe this isn't working the way it's supposed to. Like, you've done two, the guy's still alive. Think of something else. Maybe a sword would be good, you know?
He's never been the ace in the...
No, no, he's not.
In the pack. Yeah.
It's just amazing. Because, you know, Voldemort is not the sharpest crayon in the box.
No, he's not.
You know?
No.
He just is so obsessed that he can't see that, you know, he may need to change his strategy slightly here.
I mean, how about being a fly on the wall when he's finding all of his destroyed Horcruxes? That was some of the funniest stuff, I think, is when we were hearing about all this happening.
Oh, it was fun.
I was getting excited, because you know he's coming.
Yeah.
You know once
he
finds that last one, he's all hell's broken loose.
That was a brilliant bit of writing, too, because it let us kind of see him taking one step at a time toward that final confrontation. But I also liked back in the you know, hanging with Voldemort in Malfoy Manor way back at the beginning, when he actually said, he has escaped because I've made mistakes.
Yeah.
And I think, okay, Voldemort's catching on. And then what does he do? The same dumb things.
Yeah.
He thinks he's killed someone, so he walks away. It's like, you know, if you just stick around and make sure the guy's dead.
That's what every evil guy does when they're lowering the heroes down onto a pit of sharks with laser beams on their heads.
Right.
They don't think they're going to swing away on dental floss.
Thank you, Austin Powers.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons that Voldemort does that, though, is because he is so afraid of death.
Yeah, sure he is.
That he doesn't want to be there when it happens. I had to think of some reason why he didn't just double-check that Harry was dead himself. Why send, of all people, Narcissa?
Well, because he's so arrogant that he doesn't think anybody would possibly ever lie to him, and he cannot fathom that she would lie for the love of her son. So I sort of get it. You know, sort of. Mm-hmm. I always wonder, like, what would have happened if he would have set Harry on fire? Drowned him.
That would have been sick.
Well, but notice that the spells were not affecting Harry. The Cruciatus Curse didn't
affect
him.
Only after he killed them, the spells were not affecting Harry.
What do you mean? Instead of an Avada Kedavra, if he would have, like, just run him through the sword?
Yeah. Sect tempered him to death.
Mm-hmm.
Would the same things have happened? I guess he would have, but Harry would have had a worse body than Slytherin.
Let's think of ways we can kill Harry besides an AK.
Falling down the stairs.
If he was burned, and he would have still lived because of that whole connection, whatever, but he really would have had trouble moving around.
Yeah.
Oh, heck yeah. He's not clear that
didn't Neville get set on fire? Whatever happened with that? Neville's like, fine. I thought he got set
on
fire.
But that was after his spells no longer work on these people because Harry died for them.
Yeah, he's still on fire.
Yeah, but after that spell, everything changes. So Harry specifically says that he's dying for everybody who's tried to help, so therefore everything Voldemort tries to do against these people is not working.
Makes me wonder how long that would last. Like, if they all just, like, sat around, like, in a circle playing Duck Duck Goose, and Voldemort's, like, whacking them with spells and getting all frustrated.
Crucio.
No, like, and Voldemort's doing everything he can to attack these people, and they're just fine. They're just
kind of sticking their tongues
playing the game. Yeah. God, that would drive him crazy. They should have strung it out longer. That would have been hilarious.
And he's kind of left eventually, just sort of standing there by the door, hitting things just out of pure frustration. Nobody's paying any attention.
Speaking of Duck, where was Fudge? What happened to him?
What does that have to do with ducks and geese?
Oh,
I
get it.
I'm just thinking of lame duck.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Wow.
What happened to Fudge? Seriously, though, I mean, I forgot.
Stayed on as an advisor to Scrimgeour. So maybe he got killed when Scrimgeour got killed.
What was the Muggle Prime Minister and his government up to?
Well, they had Kingsley, so...
Probably running away in fear. That's what I would do. No.
It's a good point, though, because, you know, in the beginning of Half-Blood Prince, we had this idea that it was spilling over into the Muggle world. We never really caught that. Well, again, of course, you have to understand, I think, Book 7 as being intentionally written with a very, very... I mean, Harry has such a limited point of view because of the situation that a lot of stuff she didn't have to try to include because, and I think it's to some extent just to protect herself. My goodness, she simply could not tell the whole tale. She couldn't tell all the things happening at Hogwarts. And so by putting Harry in that situation where he was completely cut off most of the time, it really saved her having to try to put all this stuff in there. But I would like to know.
I would, too. And that's just one thing about this. I keep going back. It's just that we had learned about this before, and I just kind of wanted to know. I mean, I just found it that no one issued a beacon for help. You know, why they didn't, you know, call for help.
Okay, think about what would they do?
Well, where were the giants?
They're on holiday somewhere.
So the people from Bobaton, for example, would they have gotten a bunch of people together and just sort of, like, attacked? Or
we could have issued those butterflies, the floors.
Oh, okay, that's movie camp. But okay, so 50 people show up. What would they have done? There was no, like, battle lines drawn to join into.
I mean, anybody in that castle would have helped.
You know, they did put out the call for help. They did. The order showed up.
Well, that's what I wasn't saying, though. I was just international call for help.
The bat signal in the sky, Sue. Is that what you wanted?
I'm sorry. Yes, the bat signal in the sky. Hey, man, we have the Starship Enterprise from the cover.
Yeah.
I thought it was
right. Big lightning bolt. That'd be cool.
All right. Well, I think that pretty much all we have time for here.
Have we concluded anything, or are we still just as conundrumed as possible?
I like the conclusion you just stumbled on, that just because we didn't read about it from Harry's point of view, it doesn't mean people that get Boba Tones and Durmstrang weren't aware of what was going on and weren't struggling with what to do themselves.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's just we had the scale of the story that we had through Harry's eyes and that Joe wanted. And
she really had to, considering the space she had. And then think about, too, this whole really only took place over, what, about 9 months? You know, there barely was time for people really to register and to... I mean, you had a Britain covered with snatchers and Death Eaters and... But, you know, for people on the outside to really even start to put together what was going on.
Well, I don't think it was a mechanism of her needing room in the book. I think she's just, this has always been Harry's story, and we needed to go along with Harry wherever he was going. And so if that was out in the world with a million things happening, the book would have reflected that, you know.
Pretty good stuff,
excellent.
Guys.
We're still conundruming along.
As we pat ourselves on the back for another excellent conundrum.
I like that word.
Conundrum. That's exactly right. That's what it was. It was
conundrum. Canon conundrums.
We shall see everybody back next week for another Canon conundrum. See you guys.
I have the Catch Love song in my head.
Oldie baby, Lucius baby. I like the Parson Mouse song, but I like my Lucius Freebie one. I did too.
What happened to Lucius?
Well, I did want a Lucius baby, but the Parson Mouse one on the disc is pretty good too.
But, you know, Oldie baby.
Saying.
Oldie's a little more mainstream
with them,
there.
Or a trio
so.
Or something with them. I like the Parson Mouse. I like the Moaning Myrtles. I like the vocal girls.
But I gotta tell you, the ones who came up out of nowhere and surprised the heck out of me were the Mudbloods.
Oh, that's really cool. They're really good.
Wait until you hear the Mudbloods song. It's like this, like, Woody Guthrie meets maybe the Hold Steady, or it's just this awesome little tale about the reindeer all dying and the Thestrals taking over for Christmas. No, it's not sad at all. The Thestrals save the day. And
how is it not sad that the reindeer died?
Well, it's sort of in the way it's presented. It's just like, oh, the reindeer died. Oh, okay, move on with the story.
What the hell stopped me in my tracks?
No, it doesn't do anything.
What happened? Did they eat some poison?
I think that they were Death Eaters.
Was it the Grinch?
It was the Death Eaters in the North Pole.
They got run over by...
That's pretty low, Death Eaters.
But whatever, it's a really cute... And it's just such a catchy little jingle. It's just completely stuck in my head.
For reindeers.
So, I love the TV.
Hey, speaking of holidays, guys. What should we do for our Pottercast Halloween episode?
Ooh, spooky.
I don't know.
I really don't know either.
We haven't done that much in the past. This will be our third Halloween.
That's ridiculous. Yeah. I'm done after this Halloween.
John.
I have a thing. I can only do so many Halloween Pottercasts.
Well, what happened in the third year of Halloween? What happened in the Prisoner of Azkaban Halloween?
That's a good question. I don't know, and I should know that. Because
I don't remember. Oh, isn't it when Sirius Black breaks into...
Is that when he comes in?
Oh, fun.
Is it Halloween?
Yeah.
Right?
Maybe so.
I think so.
And because I just associate... Troll in the Pottercast!
No. Do you want to have a troll step through the Pottercast?
That might get annoying.
My little boy loves that scene, though. It's just so, because the way that whole scene is all decorated with all those treats and stuff.
What about like a trick-or-treat something? How can we do trick-or-treat?
What if we had some of the crafty girls around here and helped us make some Halloween crafts?
That'd be interesting.
Or if you don't like that
idea. We can do crafting at home. We can do crafting with Potter Cats.
Yeah.
That'd be kind of cool. How to decorate for the holidays.
That could be cool.
Do you guys carve pumpkins? Do you guys do them?
I try. I usually just end up with pumpkin mash. Do you know what I did one year with my friend Kathleen? It's complete.
Yeah.
Let's just show the ridiculous fan kind of things we do. We made pumpkin juice.
Did you really?
Real
pumpkins?
Do you know what it takes? Do you know the effort it takes to make? You need a machine. You have to take a cheesecloth.
Perhaps a juicer?
The pumpkin stuff through the cheesecloth. No, you can't use a juicer because it's, I don't know, maybe you can. We didn't have one. She was in college. And so we basically actually squeezed the juice out of a pumpkin. It was disgusting.
Why would you drink that? That's disgusting.
We didn't. We added apple juice to it at the end because we didn't make
it. So you
mashed
it in an apple.
Pumpkin
flavored things are delicious if you do it right. This apple orchard near my house makes apple donuts and pumpkin donuts,
yes.
And they're to die for. Sue knows being up in there, up north near the orchards.
Yes.
You know, hot apple cider, you can make a pumpkin version of that. Probably would taste like pumpkin juice.
Now I need to make something fallish. I just made a big thing of butternut squash soup.
Ooh, yum. That's one of my favorite soups.
Hey, guys, what about a call-out show for Halloween?
Oh, that'd be fun.
And we can trick-or-treat people.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Or we could... You know, we could do it like your favorite, like Harry Potter Halloween
well,
stories.
Well, it could be like trick or treat. Like we can say like, if they get a treat, then I don't know what could be a treat.
We don't have any treats to be giving, but they won't know that.
No?
We'll tell them that one is coming anyway.
No, and what about a trick? What would be a trick that we
could do? We'll scream in their ears.
That Dalish actually wins in the fight with Mama Noe or Grandma, not. Mama Noe with Grandma Neville.
Did she make an appearance I wasn't aware of?
Yes!
You said royalties coming our way, if that's the case.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, I want to see a picture of you. What did you dress up when you were a little kid? I would
my
love
first
to
one, my first ones, I was a crayon. A Crayola crayon. My family was just going through albums, actually. I'll ask them if they could find any of the Christmas or Halloween
that's
costumes.
Awesome.
Wow.
That's great.
My little nephew Charlie is going to be a cow because he's able to make his animal sounds now, and the one who does the best
Aww.
Is the cow.
Aww.
So we have a cow costume. It's hilarious.
Charlie was the best when we met him in Ohio.
Oh, he's a doll.
Doll baby.
Well, yeah. Kiddos and gangs and friends,
yeah.
It's that time again, I suppose.
Ooh, Halloween. Coming.
It's hard to be thinking of Halloween because now I've got all this Christmas music.
I
you
know.
Know.
I counted up today how many times I listened to the songs. 382.
Is that
it's
right?
Ridiculous.
Already? Wow.
It's ridiculous. I just keep it on repeat. I love it.
So when are we going to be selling the Wizard of Rock Thanksgiving compilation album?
You make all those songs and send them to me and we will send them off to be pressed.
Sweet.
How many pilgrim songs are there, John? I really would like to know.
We little pilgrims are we. We go to Hogwarts, don't you see? Hey, look at me. Hey, look at you.
I'm John Noe.
Get out of my bathroom, you're really creepy. You're a pilgrim
Boy,
and you need some turkey.
You don't belong here.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know.
Okay.
And then I die.
Until then, you better keep
Wrong
twiddling
album.
Those dials.
The next password will be... Jingle bells.
Jingle bells.
Keep each other safe. Keep safe.
Good night.
We've missed it.
Dobby is free.
I confess myself disappointed.
Now, if you don't mind, I'm going to bed.
Great Scott, no wonder. Look at the time. We've been here nearly 4 hours. Spooky how the time flies when one's having fun.
Hi, Pottercast listeners. This is Lauren from the Moaning Myrtles here to let you know about Jingle Spells. It's a Wizard Rock Christmas album brought to you by the Leaky Cauldron to benefit literacy around the world. It features 14 songs from a bunch of Wizard Rock bands, including us, the Moaning Myrtles. Here's a quick tease of our new song on the compilation, and it's called Rocking Around the Bathroom Stall.
Rocking around the bathroom stall, 'cause there's nothing else to do. I didn't get asked to the U-Ball, so I'm feeling pretty blue. Rocking around the bathroom stall, no one wants to be my date. It's down low and Christmas joy and suddenly filled with hate.
This record is now available for pre-order, but it will only be on sale through December 10th and only a limited supply is available. So get your copy now by following the link at the top of pottercast.com.
This week's Pottercast was produced by the Pottercast Trio and Steve Bonnet. This show was edited by Steed, Hildy, Samantha, and Liz. Thanks to Steve Vander Ark for joining us for Canon Conclusions. Thanks to our Scribby 5 team, Aaron and Nina. And thanks, as always, to our awesome transcription elves for transcribing this and all our other episodes on Pottercast.com. For more information about the show and how to contact us and be a part of future episodes, visit Pottercast.com. I'm so excited about the tension. Oh no, my phone's ringing.
Oh, she noticed her phone.
It's a tiki room.
Phone into a theater.
Steve, it's going to get you. You're going to be in big trouble.
Sorry. I love that song. In the tiki 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 room.
In the tiki 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 room. In the tiki 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 room.
All the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room.